Golf Smarter number 99 for November 6, 2007.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The Little Green Book of Golf Law with John Meinen.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading the Golf Smarter podcast. Today, Kenny Nicholson of Edwin Watts Golf will continue the discussion on shortening your driver shaft. He'll talk about lining up your golf ball and announce the winner of our drawing for the shirt and pants of your choice from Cutter & Buck. Our guest today is John Meinen, professor of law at the University of San Diego, where he teaches property, land use planning, and water law. He's well-respected and has published countless reports and proceedings, but he's also a golf nut who's put together a great little book about 19 different cases that have gone before the courts because of something that has happened on or around a golf course. If you're one of those people who appreciates and may even be entertained by legal battles in literature, movies, or TV, or you like to quote the rules of golf while you're on the course, then this book is for you. If you're not like that, then the next half hour may be all you need, right? Because, hey, quote one or two of these stories, and I promise your golf partners will be impressed. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Fred. Delighted to be able to join you today, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm delighted that you're here because this is a topic that we really don't cover very often. And I really want to start with rules of golf. Some rules seem to be designed out of sheer etiquette. Some rules can affect pace of play. Some are just basic traditions of golf. But some rules are because there's a law involved. We're getting the legal aspects, right?
That's right. But there's a risk of overstating that. And maybe we can talk about this in a little bit more detail as we canvass the subject. But the California Supreme Court, a couple of months ago, said that the safety rules dealing with such things as making sure people are out of the way, and there are actually four different safety rules under the etiquette section of the rules of golf, do not create legal obligations. So I think we really need to separate out the idea of legal obligations imposed by statutes and case law from any of the rules of golf, because there really isn't a very good fit between the two.
And why is that?
Well, I think the California Supreme Court in this case, Shin versus On, which is a 2007 decision, said that etiquette rules are simply etiquette rules. So the safety provisions contained in those etiquette rules, such as shouting a warning of four and so forth, are not intended to create a legal obligation, and the courts were not simply willing to recognize that they do create a legal obligation. So it's a very interesting commentary, and I'd say that most golfers are unaware of the distinction between the rules of golf as they may pertain to safety and legally imposed rules.
Are there cases in which somebody yelled four and hit someone and that person took legal action?
Oh, there are lots of cases like that.
Really?
In fact, this may be surprising to your listening audience, but if you were to rate sports based on litigation, the number one sport producing litigation is baseball. The number two sport is golf.
And when you say baseball, are we talking participatory or as a viewer,
We're
as a spectator?
We're talking about the full range of activities, everything from spectators who may be hit by a foul ball to a unhappy batter who's hit by a pitch ball going after the pitcher and injuring the pitcher. So wide array of interesting ways in which legal issues creep into the subject matter of sports.
Mm. So let's talk about the safety issues. And I mean, of course, I want to relate some of this to us being everyday golfers and how this is going to impact us, you know, and sometimes we act without thinking, and especially when we're playing golf, we can get frustrated at times. But we should really be aware of the legal ramifications of some of our actions.
Sure. Well, there probably the most common kind of case that a golfer will encounter is either being hit by another player's ball or hitting somebody else with their ball. Mm-hmm. And there are basically three theories that are typically advanced in those kinds of cases. One theory is that is based on what we call an intentional tort. That is, the person intended the consequences of the action. I'm reminded of the movie Sideways. You remember that that movie where Jack and Miles are touring the Sonoma wine country, and because of their slow play, the group behind hits into them, and Miles, upset with that turn of events, takes the ball and hits it back at the group behind and rattles the ball off of the golf cart, the group that hit into them. Thereafter, things escalate. Well, there's an instance where we could hold Miles if an injury occurred based on an intentional tort, perhaps an assault and or a battery. So that's one common theory you see emerge from these kinds of cases. Second kind of theory, which is oftentimes argued, is that players engaged in reckless behavior. Maybe the best illustration of reckless behavior is the kind of situation where a golfer is on the tee and knows that somebody is in the proximity of the shot and nonetheless hits the ball. So that might be covered under the theory of reckless behavior.
Yeah, they want to, like, get someone to hurry up. There's
exactly.
Slow play. Come on, let's just hit into them and make them move a little faster.
Exactly. And the last legal theory that we see, now that in California has really been, to a large extent, scotched, which is to say that it's not likely to be available under most circumstances, is that is the golfer is negligent. Of course, golfers can be negligent, but the instance where a golfer is not negligent is where a ball in flight hooks or slices or shanks and hits another person. In California, the law is pretty uniform that a golfer who injures another as a result of an inadvertent striking of the ball is not likely to be held accountable under the theory of negligence.
I mean, come on. If you can't hit a target when you're playing golf and you're trying to, I mean, you know, all you're trying to do is get to the hole. But if there's a person there and you try to hit them and you do, what are the chances of that happening? I'm sorry I'm laughing, but I just think it's kind of ridiculous.
Well, in the last illustration that we were talking about inadvertent hooks or slices of
right.
the ball. Under those circumstances, the courts have said, you know, the fact that somebody slices a ball or hooks it and injures another, that's kind of an inherent risk of the game when you go on the golf course. So we're not going to be able to hold that person accountable on the theory of negligence.
Yay.
We could hold that person if he were engaged in intentional or reckless conduct. We could hold him accountable for any injuries that he does.
Well, that seems to be fair. Does California seem to be more litigious about this than any other state?
I wouldn't say more litigious. This most recent case by the California Supreme Court was based on some sister state decisions from a whole variety of states that had previously decided that there are certain inherent risks associated with the sport of golf that a participant assumes when he or she steps on the golf course. And one of those inherent risks is somebody may inadvertently hit a ball that injures him or her. So that's an inherent risk of the game.
And then you have people who have temper tantrums.
Yes, that's a wonderful illustration. It goes back to our movie Sideways. In my book, I detail a case out of the state of Hawaii where a golfer unhappy with either the Menahunes sneaking around the golf course and stealing his ball or causing him to miss shots decides to take it out on a flock of birds that were near the tee box. And he clubs one of the birds with his Big Bertha driver.
Oh, no.
And kills the bird.
Well, this guy was determined to get a birdie no matter what.
Yeah, that's the one way of expressing it. What our friend, Mr. Pupis, did not realize, and this is outlined in the first chapter or whole to my book, is that he had a date with the law, because it turned out that the bird that he killed, which was about, 2 feet tall, was the state bird of Hawaii, the nene goose, and also an endangered species. So he got in trouble quickly with the law, and the case went off in the direction as to whether or not he would be required to forfeit all of the clubs, golf clubs in his golf bag, or just his assault weapon, which was Bertha.
I feel like if I had a sound effects button right now, it would go wah, wah.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mention that, because for those interested viewers, I have in that chapter the website to the Nene Goose, so you can go listen to the trumpeting sound that is made by this this goose if you're really interested in pursuing the bird lover side of the case.
I laugh only because sometimes people can be really stupid, and they don't think about the actions that they're doing and what the ramifications are. Was this a fun book to put together for you?
This was a fascinating experience for me. As you may know, it was born of my shameless love affair with the game of golf and the law. When I first started collecting opinions on golf, I didn't intend to write a book, but with the passage of time, the project took on a life of its own, and what resulted is this collection of interesting cases, 19 in all, followed by a section after each case dealing with what I call Inside the Rules, which is an attempt to look at certain rules of golf and connect them up, if you will, to the substantive principles of the case. So it's been great fun for me, and hopefully it'll be both entertaining and educational for your viewers.
Your Honor, help us out. What are things that we really should be paying attention to that could get us in trouble in the long run? I would think that two things that come to my mind as being the most common issues are playing on a golf course that is lined with homes.
Well, absolutely. This is another very common kind of situation. In fact, I was playing not too long ago with a colleague of mine who hooked the ball and smashed it through the neighbor's window. And the question was, what, if any, liability does the golfer bear for that common kind of occurrence where the ball goes off the course and causes some injury?
He must have been very happy you were with him at the time.
Well, actually, he was a lawyer, too.
Okay.
I think most people in that situation are more than willing, most people who I play with, are more than willing to assume some responsibility for the damage they cause. Not everybody fits in that category. In fact, in my book, I have a chapter dealing with a situation where the people are not so forthcoming with regards to admitting their responsibility for such damage. But it's been always interesting to me to ask the question, what is the theory of liability when you cause damage to property off the course? Many golf courses will have signs posted around saying that the golfer is responsible for any damage he causes. You're probably familiar with those signs, and your audience may also be familiar with that type of sign.
Sure.
The real question is, would the law impose a legal obligation based on that kind of signage? I have serious doubts as to whether or not that follows. Many golf courses wind up redesigning golf course holes because of the number of property damage claims associated with the design of the hole, the layout of the hole relative to property. So I think the golf course is exposed to liability on the theory that if the hole has been poorly designed, and as a result of that design and the fact that we know that golfers don't always hit shots straight, the golf course may have certain liability here, which transcends, I think, the individual golfer's responsibility.
So you're saying that if I hit an errant shot, it hits a house, it breaks a window, they want me to pay, I can say, you know what, if the course was designed better, that wouldn't have happened. I could blame the designer and the owner of the course?
I think that's exactly right, Fred.
Wow.
Now, what we'd have to back up and say is that, there isn't a whole lot of litigation on this, because if you break somebody's window, what are we talking about, $50,
$100? Yeah.
This is not a matter that is going to be litigated. Rather, it's going to be settled out, and most of the golfers who caused the damage, as I say, say, okay, I'll be responsible for it. Whether or not the law would hold them accountable is, I think, a much closer question.
John, there was one of these chapters here. I apologize for not getting to read the whole book. I was going like word for word. I was having so much fun. I haven't had a chance to finish. But the one of these titles here really intrigued me. Hole 13 here. You can lose more than your golf balls during a round of golf. Could you please explain that to me?
Sure. Let me set the stage for this particular case. It was 1995. The golf course was an executive-style golf course in Rancho Bernardo area of California.
Which, unfortunately, we've heard too much about in the news recently.
Great struggles in our area with the fires, and I appreciate your expression of concern. But as you look out from the driving range, which looks downhill, to the right of the driving range, there's a stand of mature pine trees. And that stand of mature pine trees separates the driving range from the ninth hole, which players play up the hill towards the ninth hole. Well, on this ill-fated day, Stanley had hit his ball not out of bounds on the driving range, but into the trees. And he went into the trees to retrieve the golf ball to play his next shot, and he heard this loud crack, at which time a limb of about 750 pounds fell from the pine trees and pinned him to the ground and caused him serious injury.
Ouch.
His playing partners finally got him extricated under the tiny grasp of this limb, and they wound up taking him to the hospital, and as you can imagine, he was not very happy with his situation. So he sued the golf course, and one of his theories was that they had been negligent in maintaining the pine trees, and that they should have been thinned, and this was not an act of God. His wife joined the litigation, and this is the sex part of the case. She joined it for loss of consortium. Loss of consortium is a legal theory that allows a man or a woman who loses the comfort of his or her spouse to join in the litigation for purposes of the loss of that comfort. We call it loss of consortium. Well, the Garashes were ultimately successful. Stanley recovered $55,000 in damages, and his wife for loss of his services because he had become sexually dysfunctional, was compensated in the amount of $5,000. Now, as Paul Harvey...
I guess he wasn't that good, but go ahead. Well, I'm sorry.
He was age 74.
And, oh, was he really?
And, of course, the golf course argued that his advanced age may have contributed to some of his loss of performance. But in any event, that's the tie to the notion that you can lose more than your golf ball scoring a round of golf. Well, what your listeners may be interested in is that after the book was published, I received an email from the trial judge in the case, and he said, let me tell you the rest of the story. He said, I thought you might find it interesting to know that during the trial, we had the request by the defense counsel for a jury view of the accident site, that is where the tree branch fell on the plaintiff. The defense counsel chartered a bus, which had to be specially outfitted with a wheelchair lift because one of the jurors was disabled. They traveled out to the golf course and were escorted to a whole series of golf carts, and all of the jurors and court staff and counsel jumped in these two-person golf carts and set off for the scene of the accident. They arrived at the accident scene, which was not too far from the clubhouse, and the jurors dismounted and began wandering around the area on their own. After about a 5 or 10 minute of meanderings through the pine trees, they heard this loud crack, and another large tree limb, not as big as the one that pinned the plaintiff, came crashing down, and within a couple of yards to some of the jurors. Oh. And this was a holy smoke kind of event. The trial judge immediately directed the bailiff to get everybody off the golf course, and they headed back to the courthouse, where the golf course then, in short order, lost their lawsuit that this was an unforeseen act of God, that this was, in fact, improperly maintaining of the trees. So I think that's kind of interesting at a couple of different levels. One is it just shows you that you never know what's going to happen at trial, and you never know what's going to happen on a golf course.
No, you don't, and I'm sure glad we didn't get to hear about this 70-plus-year-old woman's sex life any more than we had to. But I was thinking that the story was going to go that here's the judge and the jury and everybody else standing on a golf course, and somebody hit into them because they were slowing down the pace of play. It's like, hey, come on, I want to play golf here. What are you guys standing out there for?
No, I think we'll put that the erectile dysfunction part of this case to one side.
Yes, thank you very much. But what about acts of God? I mean, I understand that there are many people who are struck by lightning on a regular basis in golf courses all over the world.
Well, one of my favorite movies, and it may be yours, is Caddyshack.
Of course.
And in Caddyshack, you remember Bill Murray, who is the groundskeeper assigned to rid the course of the dreaded groundhogs that were tearing up the course. Well, Carl is outside the clubhouse, and he has his grass scythe that he knocks the grass down, and he's pretending that he's in the Masters competition. And he's using his grass whip to hit the heads off peonies, or maybe they're chrysanthemums, I can't recall. In any event, he's swatting one head of the flower and another, and Bishop Bickering comes up and says, Carl, I want you to caddy for me. And at the time, it's starting to cloud up and threatening. And the bishop is in the midst of what he calls the best round of his life. And it's starting to storm with some intensity, and lightning starting to happen. And the bishop finally misses a putt and raises up his club and yells a something that we probably shouldn't share, but he was unhappy with the putt. He's unhappy with God, and all of a sudden a lightning strike hits him and knocks him to the ground. So lightning on a golf course is a serious problem, notwithstanding the humorous episode in Caddyshack. In fact, it accounts for about 5%, my recollection is, 5% of the deaths from lightning strikes. So it's a common occurrence on golf courses. People need to appreciate that Ben Franklin had it right when he said that metal and lightning don't mix unless you're trying to generate electricity, in which case you don't want to be holding up a golf club. You may remember the 1975 story where Lee Trevino, the Merry Max, was hit during the Canadian Open.
Hit by lightning.
Hit by lightning.
Right.
And famously thundered after being hit by lightning that he should have held up a one iron because even God can't hit a one iron. And that's where that expression came from, and it's commonly used throughout. What is little known is that Trevino's playing partner was also hit by lightning during that same 1975 Canadian Open. So lightning strikes are common on golf courses, and it's surprising the number of professional golfers who have been hit by lightning. So,
sure. But what kind of legal action can someone take if they get hit by lightning?
Well, like most lawyers would say, it depends.
Thank you very much.
On the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, golf courses are increasingly put to the task to have some kind of a management plan to alert golfers of the dangers of lightning during various rounds of golf. So it does seem as though that there is an increasing responsibility on golf courses to have some kind of a management plan. But the truth of the matter is that lightning strikes are defensible under the idea that it's an act of God beyond the controllability of any golf course to control. But if, for example, a golf course designs a golf shed to be utilized to protect golfers during lightning storms and it's improperly grounded or properly located, there may be some exposure to liability part of the golf course.
Very interesting. Well, John, thank you so much for your time. This is really entertaining, and it's a fun little book to have. It's a great gift to give to somebody, but it's a good one to have just because it's the kind of conversation that you'd love to have on the golf course with people. Going, you know, I read this story the other day. It's one of those things that people are, you read that? Awesome. So it's called The Little Green Book of Golf Law, The Real Rules of the Game of Golf by John Meinen. And John, thanks again so much for sharing some of these great stories with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I hope that your listeners appreciate that in many respects golf is like life. Sometimes things go your way, other times they don't. When they don't, make sure you know you go a good lawyer.
And now it's time for our counsel, Kenny Nicholson. Do you need informed answers about specific golf gear or have questions about what to look for when buying new golf products? Kenny Nicholson, technical specialist at EdwinWattsGolf.com, is here to help. To submit your question, go to GolfSmarterPodcast.com and click on the button labeled Ask Kenny. If we use your question on the show, we'll send you a free Golf Smarter Edwin Watts Golf hat. Ask Kenny is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf and EdwinWattsGolf.com, America's Golf Club. Kenny Nicholson, are you there?
How are you? I'm in awe. That was awesome, Fred.
What, the new script or what?
That was very good, my friend.
I just need to mix things up every so often, you know. Keep people on their toes. Keep me moving here. How are you?
Had me shocked.
Well, you were gone. I thought we lost the Skype connection here for a second. We got a lot to cover today. And questions from all over the world that are quite interesting, so let's get to it. Do you mind?
Not at all.
You don't want to chit-chat for a minute?
How's the fires doing out in California?
All gone? World Series
Wonderful.
Is over? Okay.
That's awesome.
And the Arctic ice is melting. Okay, so this question comes from Jude Barker of United Kingdom. He says, do clubs, particularly irons, wear out? The reason I ask is because my favorite set is a 1978 set of Hogan Medallion irons. I've played with them since 1984, and even though I have tried other more modern sets, nothing compares to the quality and feel of my Hogans. I think he sleeps with his, with my Hogans. Friends tell me that the grooves are all worn out and that the shafts have lost their temper. As far as I can tell, the clubs still perform okay. The steel shafts have some bag marks, but are still straight, and despite the sweet spots wearing on the faces, the heads are pretty fair, too.
Irons are not going to wear out, and the shaft's probably not going to wear out on steel. What is going to wear out are going to be the grooves on the face of the golf club.
And I think that's what he's asking about.
Exactly. And, you know, when you're making contact with a golf ball that has sand on it, obviously it's going to scuff the face, and over time it's going to erode the grooves. But all he needs to do is to have the clubs regrooved. It's something that we do, not all the time, but there are people that have older sets of golf clubs that love them and want to continue using them, and we can have those regrooved for you. That's not a problem. But as far as the steel shaft wearing out, no. And unless the golf clubs were under extreme heat to cause the molecular structure to change in the shaft, the shaft is going to be as consistent as it was when he first got them. But as far as that iron, that is a terrific iron that was extremely popular in its time and a very wonderful iron to play. If I was him, and it sounds like he still enjoys playing them, I would just probably have the clubs that need to be regrooved, have those regrooved, and obviously look at the grips. The longer irons are probably, don't need to have anything done to them. It's typically the shorter irons that you see the grooves need to be redone on.
You know, I promise, Kenny, I'm not going to tell your boss you just lost a sale.
But hey, Jude, for the benefit of Evan Watts Golf, I do think it is time for you to go ahead and get a new set of golf clubs. So give us a call today. We're glad to set you up.
Okay. Hey, you know, you mentioned the shafts. The metal shafts aren't going to have any effect there. But I do want to let you know that we received, this is becoming a hot topic, this whole thing about cutting down the shaft we talked about last week. We got
right.
A couple of emails from people who have read Tom Wishon's book that we've had Tom on the show a couple of times, Picking the Perfect Golf Club and Picking the Perfect Driver. And they want to dispute what you're saying, and they are, you know, based on what Tom says about, you know, shortening the length of the shaft of your driver.
Well, I mean, it's not the first time that I've had an opinion that's different than another guest that you've had on the show. But what I said was that it might not be best for everybody to just go out there and cut an inch off of the shaft from 45 to 44 inches, because it changes the dynamics of the golf club. You know, when you order it from a manufacturer to a specific length, you know, you can cut it from the tip of the shaft, which is the part that goes into the golf club, or you can cut it from what we call the butt end, which is where the grip goes on. And if you just pull the grip off and cut an inch off and put the grip back on, you change the dynamics of the shaft. So you have to be careful there. I said this, that a 44-inch shaft is going to be more consistent, without a doubt.
And more accurate?
It's going to be more accurate, more consistent, more accurate, whichever you want to use there. But you know, you are going to lose distance. That is a known fact. So you have to weigh the benefits there. Are you somebody that's just barely off the fairway that needs all the distance that they have? Then don't cut the shaft down. If it's somebody that's erratic that needs to make a drastic change in their driver, then yeah, let's try cutting the shaft down and see what it does for you. You are going to lose some distance, but you will gain some consistency. It's like using an 8-iron versus a 5-iron. You add more loft and a shorter shaft, you're going to add more consistency. So there's a lot of variables that come into play when you talk about drivers, and cutting the shaft down is not always the exact answer. If you were able to get on a launch monitor and try to get fitted for which loft you need, and which flex you need, that's the first step in trying to find the correct driver. You know, if you're hitting an 8-degree driver extra stiff and you swing 75 miles an hour and you barely get the ball airborne, then obviously that's not the correct golf club for you. So you need to look at all the variables and take into consideration all the things that you can change. But yeah, I mean, he's right. Cutting the shaft down is going to be more consistent, without a doubt. But if you, you know, the best thing to do is try to get on a launch monitor. And I will tell you, I got on one this past week, and I was up in Atlanta. Went by our store up there in Piedmont and got on a launch monitor and found out that, yeah, the driver that I'm using right now currently is the correct driver for myself. But it's funny when you do that, because I hit about four different drivers, and there was about a 15-yard discrepancy there between drivers, and all things were considered equal except for loft and shaft brand per se, because I was hitting a couple different brands, all with about the same loft, 9 to 9.5, and all with a stiff shaft. But I was it was several different shafts and several different manufacturers, and it's really neat. If you have the opportunity to do it, it would behoove you to go ahead and have that done.
15 yards difference?
I'm telling you the honest
That's
truth.
That's amazing. I mean, what about your accuracy? Was it still there? Or?
Oh, man, I am so accurate. It's scary. I mean, accuracy. Driver, I hit it pretty good. The big thing that I was looking at was spin rate and trajectory. And it's just funny how trajectory and spin rate have so much to do with total distance. Too much spin is going to give you too much lift and not enough roll. The right trajectory and the right spin, obviously, and it can account, you know, for me it was a 15-yard difference from the worst to the best. For some people it could be more than that, and for some people it might not be as much. But that's why it's beneficial to get fitted on a launch monitor for a driver.
Excellent. Excellent.
We took that question a long way, but hopefully it helps you understand
A
little bit more of the dynamics of the driver.
It's all about the education, I think, and you're providing a great one. And having differing opinions is awesome. That's what we want here. We want everyone to have their own opinion. Grant Thornton from New South Wales down in Australia in Condell Park, he wants to know, this is really interesting. Let me set this up a little bit here. He hits his driver 240 yards. He hits his 5-iron 175 yards. He's got a 10 handicap, and he plays about 75 times a year. And he asks this question. Do you gain more distance using the Titleist Pro V1 by positioning the ball with the arrow line aimed at the target? And if you hit a shot with the line sitting sideways, will the ball balloon? He said, when the seam is sideways, I find that I have to take an extra club to compensate.
Man, that guy, he is totally mental. It's true that we sell this tool called a Check Go Sweet Spot Finder, where you put a golf ball on there and you press a button and it spins the golf ball at a certain RPM.
I love my Check Go.
Yeah, so you have one. I have one. I don't use it, you know, that much. It doesn't make that big of a difference to me. But you can.
To me, it's all about confidence thing. It's like, okay, I know. Like, I love mainly for putting.
Yeah, that's true. To me, it's the big benefit there is in putting.
But I use it for when I drive, too.
Yeah, you get a more true roll. I will tell him this, that when I play, whether it's a Pro V1 that has the arrow or another golf ball on the side of the golf ball, not so much the brand, let's say you're playing a different type golf ball, but it tells you which ball that is, whether it's a Platinum by Nike or whatever ball it is. I use those smaller letters as my sight line, basically like Titleist does with the arrow that they use on theirs. They actually call that an AIM side stamp. And what that stands for is Alignment Integrated Marking. Okay, there you go.
AIM.
You learned something new.
It's AIM.
But it is. It's AIM. And I use that off the tee. And for no other particular reason other than it helps me line up, you know, in which area I'm going to hit the golf ball. I don't do it for finding center of gravity on the golf ball or anything. And I also use it every time when I'm on the green. If you'll notice, let's take Tiger, for example, whenever he lines up a putt, that's what he does. He takes his alignment aid, whatever he's using, obviously it's a Nike golf ball, and he lines that up on the mark that he has on the green that he wants to putt to. I think that's a huge benefit. A lot of people don't do that. A lot of people just walk up to the green, they put their ball down on their mark, and then they find a spot and they aim to that. I think it would be very beneficial if you took the time to actually line the mark up at your target line and putt to that. It gives me a better way of aiming the putter.
Oh, for me, I'll tell you, I use it not just for lining up where I want the direction of the ball to go, which is the obvious one, is like, okay, once you take that out of the mix, once you stand up at the ball, once you address the ball, and that line tells you what, you know, what the line you're going to putt your ball on, all you have to do is concentrate on the speed at that point.
But there you go.
But for me, it also allows me to put my feet parallel to that line to make sure that my feet are in alignment.
That's if that helps your problem.
It doesn't. I still am a crappy putter.
it makes it so much easier to line. You're right. It makes it so much easier to line it up, and then at that point, all you need to really consider is speed.
So what you're saying here is that he shouldn't. The ball's not going to balloon necessarily just because the line is sideways.
No, there's no ball is going to be so defective that it's going to make that big of a difference where it's actually wobbling when you hit it out there. So, you know, you'd be surprised using one of those Check Go sweet spot finders. This particular individual would probably love this training aid or this tool because he could mark every golf ball and find out where the center of gravity is. And if that is his case, and it's a real mental aspect of his game, with this tool you can actually mark the center of gravity, and there's a place on the side of it while the ball's spinning, you put your permanent marker on there, and it actually marks a line around the golf ball, and that's, you use that as your alignment aid, or whenever you put it on the tee, and it gives it a more true flight. But in putting, I think it makes the biggest difference. If a ball is out of round just a little bit, it can, you know, on a 20 or 25-foot putt, it can make a little bit of a difference. So,
and, you know, these Check Go Pros and the Check Go, they're no more than the cost of a box of balls, right?
$25, $30.
Yeah.
It's one of the best $25 or $30 you'll spend.
Yeah, and you get a long life out of it. And also, he's in Australia, so ordering it from Edwin Watts Golf, you may get your 10% off. You're not going to get free shipping. You might want to buy it locally. Right,
yeah, if they sell it, I'm sure they sell something like that over there. But it's a neat tool.
Yeah, it's
when you show
tool.
It to somebody that's never seen it, they are pretty fascinated by it.
Yeah. Oh, I really like mine. All right, let's give something away. Let's go back to, we've been talking about the Cutter and Buck pants and shirt. Now this is really cool what you've offered here. The winner, today's winner, will get to choose any shirt and any pant that is in the Cutter and Buck line that is carried by Edwin Watts Golf, correct?
That is correct. Great. I love this prize.
Yeah, well, it's Cutter and Buck is high-end clothing. This is a nice gift. This is really nice. All right, and we have received 233 entries. I've sorted the names randomly, and you get to pick a number between 1 and 233, and you can pick 1, or you can pick 233. I will tell you that 232 people will be disappointed that I didn't do it fairly.
I can never do this right.
Well, you got to do it, and the number you're going to select is?
I'm going to go with 2.
Number 2.
I'm going low.
You're going...
I haven't gone low. I mean, I'm going low. There was one time. He never goes low. He never goes high.
Hey, listen, you know, if you're number 2 in college football this season, that's not going
to
end.
Not a good place to be.
Not a good place to be. Man, oh, man. Well, anyway, this clothing is going to be going all the way overseas to Cambridge in the United Kingdom, Cambridge Cams, United Kingdom. And the winner's last name is Sale. And it's Peter Sale of...
Congratulations, Peter.
...the UK. Thank you, Peter, very much for entering. And please enter more often because you may have another chance to win. Well, you always have a chance to win. Everybody has a chance to win because we're going to give something else away. Kenny, what do you got in the goodie bag today?
Today I'm going to do Nakent 4DX Utility Club or Hybrid, whatever you want to call it.
It's 4D as in David
4D
X?
4D as in dog, X as in X-ray, correct.
Okay. 4DX Hybrid or Fairway Wood?
Mm-hmm. One of our more popular hybrids that we sell. Retail value about $200. The 4DX is an improvement over what they had the previous, was the 3DX. And I'll touch on it real quick. They replaced the steel crown of the 3DX with a titanium, which saved approximately 50% of the crown weight. So with that weight, they were able to make the golf club a little bit bigger, move the center of gravity further back and down. This gives you a more penetrating ball flight with a little bit less spin, is what they say, versus the 3DX. But one of our more popular hybrids, extremely easy to hit. If you don't own a hybrid, I would suggest that if you don't win this one, go out and try to hit some. It's a huge help for somebody that struggles with long irons.
Awesome. And the entry, the deadline for entry is going to be November 19th. It's a Monday, and we'll stop the entries at noon on Monday, and we'll hold the drawing on the show that we post on November 20th. To enter, go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the word contest just below the Edwin Watts Golf banner. Once you're there, fill out your shipping information and the verification code and click submit. And while you're at that page, make sure to see what other prizes we've given away on the Golf Smarter podcast and who the winners have been. There's also a space provided there if you'd like to send me a note. I will review that and get back to you. And as a disclaimer, we've mentioned before, we'll always mention again, when you enter, your email address is provided to Edwin Watts Golf so they can send you a catalog. For more information, check your show notes. All right. Kenny,
very good,
thanks,
Fred.
So much. You know, next week's a big week here at the Golf Smarter podcast. You know that.
I do. What's that for, Fred?
Oh, it's our 100th episode, Kenny.
Whoa.
Yeah. That's. Yeah.
Seems like yesterday.
100 episodes on the Golf Smarter podcast. 100 consecutive weeks that I've been taking care
we
of business here.
Balloons and cake and all that.
Oh, we've got stuff. A party to, you'll hear. We've got a surprise for you on the opening of next week's show.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. It's been a blast.
Yes, it has, my friend, and I'll talk to you next week.
Take care, Fred.
Now, I'd like to remind you that the only charge for this program is that we truly love your feedback in one of two ways, or maybe even both. Could you please write a review in iTunes about the Golf Smarter podcast? Now, how's this for a challenge? Okay, next week, as we were just talking about, next week is our 100th episode. As of this morning, Golf Smarter boasts 90 reviews in the iTunes store, the U.S. version of the iTunes store. And here's the challenge. How about if we try to reach 100 reviews to celebrate 100 episodes? Now, of course, I want your honest opinion in iTunes, please. We always strive to deliver 5-star content and truly appreciate that we have an average of 4.5 stars on the 90 reviews currently there. So what do you say? Also, if a podcast is able to make money, there's a couple of ways to approach this. You can charge for the content, which some people do. You can ask for donations, or you have sponsorship. Personally, I prefer the sponsorship. Edwin Watts Golf is a great example of what a wonderful sponsorship package can do. So we're looking for golf sponsors who will provide free stuff for you. So to get them interested, they want to know who's listening. So if you could also fill out the listener survey at golfsmarterpodcast.com, that would be a great help. I received an email from someone saying, hey, this is just generic information. Why am I filling this out? Because it really does help. I want to thank again John K. Minan, M-I-N-A-N. His new book is The Little Green Book of Golf Law, published by the American Bar Association, and can be found at your favorite bookstore or online book sites. If you hold on before you purchase the book, soon golfsmarterpodcast.com will feature links to purchase books that we discuss on the show, so you don't have to shop any further than golfsmarterpodcast.com. We close this week's show with a quote submitted by another listener in the UK, Lee Wilson, quotes Ben Hogan, who once said, "Reverse every natural instinct and do the opposite of what you're inclined to do, and you will probably come very close to having a perfect golf swing." If you have any questions, comments, quotes, or requests, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarterpodcast.com.
Hi, I'm Joanne Green of smarterpodcasts.com, where we have a growing roster of podcasts. For golfers, listen to Golf Smarter and Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf. Good Dog is for dog lovers everywhere.
Here's another Radio
Baseball Cards is a collection of stories told by the greatest players of the 20th century. and Smarter Cancer Care offers compassionate help for cancer patients and their circle of support. Please check us out at smarterpodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.